Welcome to Radio Luke Solicit. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017, and this is episode number 16. And the title of this episode is Immigration and the Roman Church State. San Diego Bishop wants you to foot the bill. Well, it's been a while since my last podcast, a lot longer than I wanted. It's been actually, I see from my records, the last one I did was on January the 21st, so it's almost 2 months to the day. And I'm kind of ashamed about that, and I do apologize to those of you who do listen to the podcast. I know that it's been a long time between drinks of water there. I'm going to blame this one on the IRS. Yeah, I know, I shouldn't blame things on other people. I know I should accept responsibility for my actions, and that's true, but, you know, I really don't like the IRS, and I kind of do have at least a little bit of an excuse here for not podcasting for 2 months. You see, I work in the financial industry, and maybe if you work in the financial business or the accounting business, or maybe you know somebody who does, you're probably aware that the first quarter of every year is a real beatdown for a lot of those people. And I happen to work in the 401k business. I do what's called compliance testing on 401k plans. If you have a 401k plan, you may or may not be aware, but they have to operate according to certain guidelines that are set down by regulations in the Internal Revenue Code, and also write some regulations that are set forth by the Department of Labor as well. And so I get to make sure that the plans are doing the things that they're supposed to do according to government regulations. And what that does is it creates an enormous amount of work because this all has to be done by March the 15th. So anyway, I get crushed for the first couple months of the year, and I'm just now coming up for air. We got done with our busy season about a week ago. And back to more normal schedule here, so Lord willing, I'll be able to start doing some podcasts here on a little more regular basis going forward. So hopefully that'll work out, because I do enjoy doing them. As far as today's podcast goes, I'm going to have to apologize a little bit in advance. I'm not super prepared, but I wanted to go ahead and get something out anyway, because I just wanted to get this done for a while. And I had a piece. This is actually a piece that I noticed back, it was put out about a month ago, about immigration and the Roman Catholic Church. And this was actually a piece that was published in a Catholic publication. It's called the National Catholic Reporter, NCR. I used to think NCR stood for National Cash Register. Apparently it stands for National Catholic Reporter as well. At any rate, the title of this particular news story that I wanted to talk about today. This is the headline in the National Catholic Reporter. It reads, quote, "In powerful speech, San Diego Bishop challenges organizers to disrupt rebuild." The piece was published February 19th by a gentleman by the name of Brian Rowe. I'm going to put a link to this article in the show notes. So if you do want to look at this and follow along while I talk through the article, just go ahead and click on that link, and that'll take you right to the article. I'm just going to read a little bit of it and comment on a few things here that are inside of in this article. I won't read all of it, but I'll just maybe make some selections here out of the piece itself. And I'll just start here right at the very beginning. This is the story begins thus. "It took all of 6 minutes for San Diego Bishop Robert McElroy to rouse a crowd of nearly 700 community organizers and social justice protagonistas by calling them to become disruptors and rebuilders amid current American politics. The speech, 20 minutes in length, but interrupted nearly two dozen times by cheers and applause, took head-on the key policies of the early presidency of Donald Trump." So we know right away that that this guy, this Brian, or excuse me, this Bishop Robert McElroy, I guess you might call him a never-Trumper. Now, before I get to talking too much about Donald Trump, I just do want to say this. You know, I have plenty of disagreements with Donald Trump, and I'm not going to sit here and just cheerlead for everything that Donald Trump does or says. However, I think with his immigration policies, as with a lot of his ideas, it's kind of an admixture of ideas. There are some things in what he says that that aren't so great, and there are some things that he says that are actually pretty solid. But of course, this Robert McElroy doesn't think any of it's any good. Thinks it's all horrible. And anyway, just reading through here some of the comments that he makes. Let's see, McElroy, he starts off by saying this. President Trump was the candidate of disruption. He was the disruptor, he said. Well, now we must all become disruptors. That's what McElroy says. So McElroy also wants to disrupt things. And he says, we must disrupt those who would seek to send troops into our streets to deport the undocumented, to rip mothers and fathers from their families. We must disrupt those who portray refugees as enemies rather than our brothers and sisters in terrible need. We must disrupt those who train us to see Muslim men and women as children, and children as sources of fear rather than as children of God. We must disrupt those who seek to rob our medical care, especially from the poor. We must disrupt those who would take even food stamps and nutrition assistance from the mouths of children, the bishop said. So there's a lot there to unpack, actually, in just that one paragraph. He obviously doesn't like the whole idea of deportation. He sort of demagogues the whole thing. He talks about ripping mothers and fathers from their families. Now, this is one of the things that I think that is interesting when we talk about deportation. There are, you read a lot of articles about this when people talk about, you see things, people say, oh, well, there's lots of fear in the immigrant community, you know, over various types of immigration raids and things. But here's the thing that is almost never pointed out, you know, and this is regardless of whether you're talking about the National Catholic Reporter or maybe something that you would read or hear in the mainstream news. And they talk about all this fear that's generated, and yet they never point out the very obvious fact. And I mean, this is such a screamingly obvious fact that you would think that you almost would say it's self-evident, although, you know, ideas are not self-evident. As a scripturalist, I realize things aren't self-evident. But I guess maybe if you wanted to say something was self-evident, you might be tempted to say this is. And the self-evident thing is this. Well, there's a good reason maybe these people ought to be afraid, because they've chosen to break the law. You know, these are adults who have come to the United States, and they've done so knowingly in an illegal fashion. Or maybe they came to the United States on a visa of some sort, and they overstayed their visa. You know, a lot of people think that the only problem, the only source of illegal immigration are, you know, maybe Mexicans sneaking over the border or something like this in the middle of the night out in the desert or something. But that's not the only source of illegal immigration. There is a tremendous amount of visa overstays. You know, people who come to the United States on tourist visas or maybe on student visas, and they just never go home. But they never do anything about their immigration status. There was an article. It's kind of interesting, and I don't have it handy here, but there was an article I saw a month or two back talking about. There was a comment by, I think he was the president of the California state legislator. Legislature. I don't know if it's the California Senate or the House or what his position was, but he was some high-powered state legislator in California, and he openly declared, he said something like, half my family is in the country illegally, you know, and as though somehow that were a good reason, you know, for there not to be deportation. And I suppose maybe if you're in the country illegally or half your family is in the country illegally, maybe you would naturally think that nobody should be deported. But, you know, nobody makes the obvious point that, you know, these people are knowingly, willingly breaking the law. Now, you know, you can argue a lot of things and say, well, you know, maybe U.S. immigration law isn't perfect. And I'll grant that. It's not perfect. But, you know, ask yourself this question. What about you, if you're an American, suppose you're an American, would you consider going to a foreign country in complete contrary, completely against that country's immigration laws? Would you sneak into Mexico and go down to Mexico and just hang out and expect the Mexican government to pay you welfare, expect to get a job, and if you didn't get the things that you expected, then to go out and to demonstrate? I mean, would you do that? And I would say that if you ask probably 99% of the American people, they would say, of course not. It wouldn't even occur to most people, most Americans, to do that, whether that country was Mexico or Canada, or maybe some other country. I mean, whether in Europe or in Asia, I mean, you just wouldn't think about doing that. And yet, somehow, it seems perfectly natural and normal for Mexicans. And I think about half the illegal immigrants in the United States, I believe I've read that someplace, are from Mexico. That it's perfectly okay and acceptable to come to the United States, and that there should be no consequences for that. That any enforcement of the law by anyone to even the smallest degree is somehow the most grievous moral crime that's ever been committed. It's ripping fathers and mothers from the children, from their families. Well, maybe they should have thought about that before they came to the United States. And of course, you always hear about families being broken up, but of course families can be reunited in the country of origin. They could simply go home. So it's not as though that's that's not an impossible solution. But this sort of thing, it's almost this shock and horror that Donald Trump actually might want to enforce U.S. immigration law, and that this is the most heinous, awful thing that's ever happened. At least apparently the bishop, the good bishop, Robert McElroy in San Diego seems to think so. And he does a lot of demagoguery here. But he goes on, he says, we must disrupt those who train to see Muslim men and women and children as sources of fear rather than as children of God. Well, the whole Muslim immigration thing is like a lot of issues with immigration. It is, let's say it's multifaceted. I think that there are actually some very good reasons why people ought to be afraid and be concerned about Muslim immigration. I'm speaking here, this is, as I said, March 22nd, just a few hours ago in London. Apparently there was a radicalized Muslim. We don't know much about this individual, but he drove a truck, I guess, into a crowd in London. And the most recent figures I saw, there were five dead and 40 people injured by this individual. And of course, that's at least the third such attack in less than a year. Back over the, during December in Germany, I guess there was a Christmas market that they had. I think was it in Berlin? It was in one of the big German cities, I believe. That some guy, he drove a truck into a crowd in this Christmas market and killed several people and injured quite a few people as well. And then, of course, there was the attack that was done on Bastille Day in Paris. I believe that was just last summer in July of 2016. And of course, there's lots of other types of acts of terrorism have been committed by Muslims. I mean, here I'm in the Cincinnati area, but here in Ohio, just last fall, there was a young man, I believe he was the son of Somali refugees at Ohio State, and he drove a truck into a crowd. He didn't kill anybody. I guess he didn't, maybe wasn't as successful as some of his brethren, successful in quotation marks there. He drove this car into a crowd, I guess tried to kill people, and he got out and he started hacking away with a machete, and he was shot and killed. So I think there's actually some very good reason for people to be concerned about Muslim refugees, Muslim migrants, Muslim immigrants. Some very obvious reasons like that, and then of course just the fact that Islam itself is not really compatible with what we would call Western political tradition. We have a tradition, a Republican, small r, tradition in this country, and of course our government, our social structures are largely formed by Christianity. And when I say Christianity, I'm talking about Reformed Christianity. I'm talking about the Reformation. I mean, we are, even in the degenerate state the United States is in right now, we are still the heirs of the Reformation. I mean, this country was founded by Calvinists. Our institutions were formed and shaped by ideas that were put forth at the time of the Reformation. And that's a very different thing from Islam. You know, Islam does not have a long history, or as far as I'm aware, any history of really fostering what's sometimes mistakenly called democracy, or free markets, or private property, or due process, and things like this. Islamic countries, by and large, are pretty brutal places. I think most people, at least most Americans, I think it would consider them to be such. I think that there is some very good reason to be concerned about large-scale sort of mass Muslim immigration. That's not nonsense. On the other hand, I think one of the problems, and this is a problem that the West has made for itself, the United States and, of course, some of the countries in Europe, is the fact that we spent basically the last 20 years or more, but especially the last 20 years, I guess, and especially going back to 2001, basically blowing up half the Middle East. If the United States weren't in the Middle East and bombing country after country after country, sanctioning people and this sort of thing, then I think there would probably be a lot less destruction, and there would probably be a lot fewer Muslim migrants, Muslim refugees, things of this sort. So to some extent, we've made some of our own problems, which just goes to underscore, you know, the fact that immigration is, immigration can be a difficult thing to talk about, not an impossible thing, but it does take some time to develop some thoughts about immigration, because there are a number of things that come together a number of things that bear on the immigration issue. And a lot of people don't realize, but foreign policy has something to do with immigration, has something to do with the refugee situation that we face in the United States and also in Europe. Foreign policy has a direct bearing on that. But generally speaking, I think probably most Americans don't pay nearly as much attention to foreign policy as what they ought to, and they don't realize that that is a significant component in what is going on. But anyway, moving on here from his comments about Muslims, it was interesting. One of the people who heard this was a gentleman by the name of John Gehring. In this article from the National Catholic Reporter, it quotes John Gehring as saying that the bishop's speech was one of the most powerful speeches I've ever seen a bishop give. This is a guy, I mean, obviously John Gehring is a Roman Catholic, so he's got some common ground there with the good bishop Robert McElroy of San Diego, and he thinks that was a great speech. He thinks that was pretty darn awesome. Reading through a few other things here, let's see, what else do we have? McElroy goes on to quote a pope. He quotes Pope Benedict here. I'll read you this here. This is McElroy speaking, quote, "This is an essentially important anchor for us in an age in which truth itself is under attack. Pope Benedict lamented the diminishment of attention to the importance of objective truth in public life and discourse. Now we've come to a time when alternate facts compete with real facts, and whole industries have arisen to shape public opinion in destructively isolated and dishonest patterns," end quote. As McElroy was speaking, this article says that it elicited a cry of "preach" from the audience. So they say, "Preach it, brother." I guess people really liked, in the audience there in San Diego, really liked what the bishop had to say. Now, I thought this was an interesting comment that Bishop McElroy made. You know, he's quoting Pope Benedict talking, who's lamenting the lack of attention to the importance of objective truth. Of course, that really raises the question. You know, what on earth does Pope Benedict know about the truth? The entire apparatus of the Roman Church state is arrayed against the truth. Of course, it probably is worth defining, you know, what is truth? You know, of course, you know, Pilate asked that famous question, you know, what is truth? Truth, I guess if you want to sum that up in a nutshell, is God thinking. You know, truth is God thinking. The Pope does not know God. And the Pope doesn't know the truth. And if the Pope doesn't know God, he doesn't know the truth. You know, you think about what how Jesus described himself. What is that in the Gospel of John? He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Now, I think that's kind of an interesting way of someone describing himself. You know, Jesus talked about himself as being the truth. You know, "I am the way and the truth," or "the way, the truth, and the life." You know, and so how is it that Jesus could talk about himself as being the truth? Well, if the truth is God thinking, you know, and Jesus is God, you know, the thoughts that Jesus thinks are the truth. And the Bible is the words is the mind of Christ written. So, I mean, Gordon Clark, if you've ever read Gordon Clark's book, The Johannine Logos, he makes an interesting point. He talks about how the Bible uses the term the Word of God to describe both the written scriptures as well as Jesus. Of course, Jesus is said to be the Word. And we talk about the Bible as being the Word. How is it that the Bible uses the same term for both Jesus Christ and the Bible? Well, it's because, you know, truth is God thinking. And, you know, we speak of the Bible as being true. Well, the Bible is simply the thoughts of God, the thoughts of Jesus Christ, in written form. So it's fair to talk about them both with the same term. You can apply the term word to both Jesus Christ and to the Bible, and that's not equivocating. We don't have all the thoughts of Christ written down, of course. We don't know everything about God, but God has revealed himself in Scripture, and the words of the Bible are the very Word of God. It's the mind of Christ. You know, we have the mind of Christ in his Word. We have the truth. And of course, you know, the Pope, whether it's Pope Benedict or Pope Francis or whatever Pope, none of those people have the truth because they don't believe the truth. They don't believe the Bible. They don't know who God is. They don't even really know who they are. They certainly don't know the truth. And it's kind of interesting to hear a Pope talk about the truth when he himself has no idea what the truth is. Moving on here. The article here in the National Catholic Register, it continues. It says, from there, McElroy hit a stride. So I guess he really, really gets going here. And it says, the San Diego bishop said that, quote, the fundamental political question of our age was whether the current U.S. economic structures would receive greater freedom or be directed in a way to safeguard the dignity of the human person and the common good of our nation, end quote. So apparently there's a conflict in the bishop's mind between freedom and having the economy directed in a way that safeguards the dignity of the human person. Well, here's the thing with the bishop. You know, I mentioned before that, you know, that Islam does not have a history or a tradition of supporting free institutions. You know, the idea of limited government, the idea of freedom of speech, the idea of private property are not things that you find very much in Islamic societies. And of course, it's because at the root of Islamic societies is the Quran, and the Quran does not understand those things. And so, people who believe the Quran, they themselves do not understand those things. They don't have the necessary ideas in their mind to be able to support a free society. Now, I don't say that because I think that Muslims are inferior people. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Muslims in their persons are inferior to say Christians. I don't mean that at all. But their ideas are inferior. Now, Islam is a heresy. Islam is a false religion. And it produces false ideas, not just about God, but about everything. You know, and that includes politics, economics, law. It doesn't have the necessary ideas to be able to support what we would consider to be a modern economy or a free society. And what is true of Islam is also true of Roman Catholicism. Roman Catholicism does not have the truth, and Roman Catholicism does not have the necessary ideas within it to be able to support a free society. And all I would do, if you don't believe that, just look at the history of societies that are dominated by the Roman Church State. You know, you get South America. You know, you get the Spanish Inquisition. That's what happens when Rome dominates societies. You do not have a free society, at least not in the sense that that probably most Americans would consider a free society. Certainly not a free society in the sense that Christians would consider a free society. So yeah, it's kind of interesting that this bishop, this McElroy, he contrasts economic freedom with on one hand, with safeguarding the dignity of the human person on the other. Well, you know, I would argue as a Christian, you know, that a free economy is the best way to safeguard the dignity of the human person. But the bishops seem to think that socialism does such a great job. And of course, obviously, when we look around the world at places like where socialism has been tried, as I said, in South America right now, or, you know, China, I mean, you've got a communist government. That's a socialist government. Nazi Germany, the Nazis were socialist. You know, yeah, I mean, it's very obvious that socialism does a great job protecting the dignity of the human person, far better than those dastardly capitalists and people who believe in limited government. At least that's what the bishop seems to think here. And the bishop continues. He says, quote, "In that battle, the tradition of Catholic social teaching is unequivocally on the side of strong government and societal protection for the powerless, the worker, the homeless, the hungry, those without decent medical care, the unemployed," McElroy said, to rolling applause. I guess he was really hitting it out of the park here. Well, you know, the Roman Catholic Church state is definitely unequivocally behind socialism. If you've ever read, and I would really, really recommend, if you have never read John Robbins' book, Ecclesiastical Megalomania, go get it and read it. You know, if you have any interest in economics, in politics, in studying the ideas of Rome, there's nothing like it out there on the market. I've never seen a book like that. It's one of my absolute favorite books. I know that sounds a little strange to say, Ecclesiastical Megalomania. How could that be a favorite book? Well, just get it and read through it, and it's a real tour de force. I can't say enough good about it. And anyway, what John Robbins does in that book is he takes a look at the origins of the social teaching, of the political theory of the Roman Church. And one of the things he finds is that Rome is unequivocally opposed to freedom. So at least in that sense, maybe that bishop, that Bishop McElroy, at least said something that's partially true. Yes, the Roman Church state is unequivocally socialist, unequivocally anti-capitalist. In fact, I'm going to read a little quote here from you. This is from Ecclesiastical Megalomania. This is actually from the introduction. This is John Robbins here. He says this. This is on page 24, at least, of my edition. I've got a paperback edition here. Quoting John Robbins, quote, "It might be expected that an institution such as the Roman Church state, ruled by an absolute emperor, structured in a rigid hierarchy, supranational in scope, aristocratic in character, and none of whose officials is elected, an institution that in more than one way is an anachronism, an institution of the ancient world, an intrusion of the ancient world into the modern, would not favor constitutional capitalism. But how deep-seated its hostility to freedom and free enterprise is, was a surprise even to this author. The popes have expressed their hatred not only for Protestantism, hatred perhaps muted recently, not by change of mind, but by the relativism of the church-state influenced by a postmodern culture, but also for the political and economic expression of Christianity, capitalism." So what John Robbins argues here, and actually throughout the pages of this book, is that capitalism is the economic expression of Christianity. Capitalism is God's economics. Maybe you could put it that way. Capitalism is the economics of the Bible. There's that one parable where Jesus, what is the parable, where the gentleman, he hires the workers to go out into the vineyard, you know, and at the end of the day, he pays the workers who started at the end of the day the same amount as he paid the guys that he hired early in the morning, and the people he hired early in the morning complain against him, and the owner of the vineyard shoots back at them, and he says, well, is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with what is mine? And of course, the answer, that's almost a rhetorical question, the answer is, of course it is. That is a defense of capitalism. And there's lots of other things in the Bible that defend capitalism, but that's one of the really clear passages in the scriptures where it talks about a defense of private property. But, I mean, you can defend private property throughout all 66 books of the Bible. The Bible is unequivocally pro-capitalism, and the Roman Church is unequivocally anti-capitalism. But then that's what we would expect, because the Roman Church state is unequivocally antichrist. We know that from scriptures, and I know that that's not something that's a very popular doctrine, but that is something that I'm convinced is the truth. And it's something that was believed by almost all Protestants until about 100 years ago, from the time of Martin Luther right up until the end of the 19th century. And it probably shocks a lot of people today, and maybe even offends a lot of people who call themselves evangelicals, but I believe nevertheless that it's also true. Continuing on here, I don't want to get too long-winded on you. There's an awful lot in here. Let's see. Here's a major point that I wanted to make, and quoting, just go ahead and quote the bishop, continuing here, quote, "In that battle, the tradition of Catholic social teaching is unequivocally on the side of strong governmental and societal protections of the powerless, the worker, the homeless, the hungry, those without decent medical care, the unemployed. This stance of the Church's teaching flows from teaching of the book of Genesis, that creation is the gift of God to all humanity. Thus, in the most fundamental way, there is a universal destination for all the material goods that exist in this world. Wealth is a common heritage, not at its core a right of lineage or of acquisition." That is really, in that paragraph right there, really gets to the heart of everything that the good Bishop McElroy is saying. And let me just repeat that here again. "Thus, in the most fundamental way, there is a universal destination for all the material goods that exist in the world." Now remember that. There's a universal destination for all the material goods that exist in the world. "Wealth is a common heritage, not at its core a right of lineage or of acquisition." This is absolutely crucial to the social teaching of the Roman Church state. And this is something that John Robbins talks about, again, in Ecclesiastical Megalomania. He talks about it several times in that book. And that is the idea, and the bishop mentions that idea here. It's called the universal destination of goods. So what's the universal destinations of goods, you might ask? Well, it's the idea that when God created the universe, that he gave the world to man collectively, that mankind collectively owns the world, and that property rights, the way that you might regard them as property rights, are not absolute. I mean, that's what that implies. It implies that everything is owned in common. Now, the Roman Church state will say that, well, yes, there is such a thing as private property, but it's not part of the natural order. It's something that's called positive law. Again, this is something that John Robbins fleshes out in more detail in Ecclesiastical Megalomania. But what they say is that the ownership of all goods ultimately, the ultimate ownership of all goods is collective. So, I mean, they're acknowledged that you have a right to your property, you know, what you would call your property. You have a right to it up to a certain point. And what they say is that point is need. And that need is ultimately is the thing that determines title to property. So if you have a possession that you don't need, that it's right and proper for the government or for the church, maybe using the government, to take what you don't need and give it to somebody who does need it. Now, of course, that raises the question of, you know, who determines what you need? Very good question. Of course, I think, you know, what Rome implies in so many words is, of course, that's up to the church. You know, so if the church determines, you know, if the bishop determines, if the bishop had the power to do this, you know, and he looked at you and said, well, you know, you have two pairs of shoes and this fellow over here doesn't have any pairs of shoes. I'm going to take one of your pairs of shoes and give it to this person over here because you obviously don't need two pairs of shoes. And you might protest and you say, well, one is work shoes and, you know, another is a pair of shoes that, you know, that I wear to church. And he might say, well, yes, but, you know, this other person doesn't have any shoes and he really, really, really needs a pair of shoes. And you know, you can wear your work shoes to church and that's fine. You can roll with that and everything's great. So the universal destination of goods is the basis for all of the social teaching of the Roman church state. And it's very interesting to see the bishop just lay that out so obviously. I want to quote you another passage from John Robinson's Ecclesiastical Megalomania, where he talks about the universal destination of goods. Let's see here. This is on page, this is from chapter 2, this is page 38. The Thomistic notion of original communism, the denial that private property is part of the natural law, but that common property is both natural and divine, is foundational to all the Roman Catholic arguments for various forms of collectivism, from medieval feudalism and guild socialism to 20th century fascism and liberalism. The popes refer to this original communism as the universal destination of all goods. John Robbins goes on to quote John Paul II's encyclical on the social concern. I'll read that to you. It's just a short paragraph here. It is necessary to state once more the characteristic principle of Christian social doctrine. The goods of this world are originally meant for all. The right of private property is valid and necessary, but it does not nullify the value of this principle. Private property, in fact, is under a social mortgage, which means that it has an intrinsically social function based upon and justified precisely by the principle of the universal destination of goods. And then John Roberts comments, he says, this principle, the universal destination of goods, is so important in Catholic social thought that all rights are subordinated to it. That's what John Robbins commenting on John Paul II there. So all rights are subjected to it. So I mean, what this Catholic bishop is saying in so many words is that immigrants or people have a right to come to this country, and they have a right to taxpayer dollars. And in fact, he says something very interesting. This is kind of skipping back to a little bit earlier in the article. But he says, we must disrupt those who seek to rob our medical care, especially from the poor. We must disrupt those who would take even food stamps and nutrition assistance from the mouths of children. Well, I mean, what he's saying there, I mean, that's a logical conclusion or a logical I guess you'd call it a conclusion, of the premise of the universal destination of goods. I mean, what he's saying is that, well, you as an American, you don't need all of this stuff, so we have a right to demand that the government take some of your money and give it to these people who showed up into the country contrary to American immigration law. And of course, Bishop McElroy thinks that that's just awesome. And the basis, the philosophical basis for that is his belief that communism is part of natural law. Now, of course, that's not the case. John Robbins makes a very interesting argument. I actually had the opportunity to read his doctoral dissertation. He wrote his doctoral dissertation. It's called The Political Thought of Sir Robert Filmer. And in that doctoral dissertation, he talks some about Filmer and about Filmer's ideas about private property. And basically what Filmer argues is that the world was given to Adam as an individual, and that Adam partitioned the world and gave part of his possession to his sons. And so on and so forth, and that, you know, that all private property actually originates in Adam. And if you approach private property that way, you can give a coherent account of how you own things. Maybe you haven't thought about that, but if you ask your question, how is it, by what right do you actually own anything? Well, ultimately, it gets back to the right of ownership that God gave to Adam. And that is a coherent account of ownership. Other non-Christian philosophies do not have a way of establishing ownership of anything. And it's maybe a little bit more that I can get into here in the podcast here tonight. It's something I've wanted to write about for some time, and Lord willing, I hope to be able to do that relatively soon. But maybe I'll just cut it off there for now, and we'll come back and talk about that at some other time. But just I would say for now that Christianity does allow us to establish private property. That private property is rooted in Adam and the fact that he ceded his property, that he donated or gave by inheritance property to his children, and that property has passed down through his children to each of us individually. And that's how we can have a coherent account of private property. On the other hand, as I said, other non-Christian philosophies have tried to justify property in other ways, and they always end up, well, let's just say they're not able to give a coherent account of private property. So let's see, we're getting up on about 40 minutes, actually closer to 45. Sorry about that. I know I've been going on a little bit long here, and I didn't even get to all the comments of the good Bishop McElroy, but I hope that gives you a little bit of flavor. And in closing, I guess I would really want to say this. One of the things that's really interesting when you study immigration, and I've spent some time here over the past year especially studying immigration, or for that matter, a lot of other social issues that we have to deal with. One of the consistent themes you find is very often the Roman church state is actually at the very root of a lot of the problems. Here we see this Catholic bishop essentially working to undermine the sovereignty of the United States of America. He's essentially acting as a fifth columnist. You might even say his remarks are a bit treasonous, I would say. If they don't technically meet the legal definition of treason, I think they could certainly be described as treasonous. And this is coming from a high-ranking representative of the Roman Church State. And I think that that's something to keep in mind. A great deal of our immigration problems can be traced directly back and laid at the feet of the Roman Church State. And maybe that's one of the bigger takeaways that you can take from this particular article. And this is in their own words. If you've not read Catholic publications before, sometimes it's interesting as an evangelical or as a Protestant to go and look at some of these things, because they can be very frank. The Romanists, they're really speaking to their preaching to the choir, so to speak, and you can really see them lay bare their ideas. So anyway, that's enough here for now. I said, Lord willing, hopefully I will be back in about a week. I think that's a good place to wrap it up. And what I would say I'd like to leave you with until next time is this thought, and that is, may the Spirit of truth guide you in all truth as you read and study God's Word. Thanks again for listening, and we will talk again next week.